Hello, I'm Teresa.
And I'm Janet Gallen.
And we welcome you to Love Letters Live.
Love Letters Live is a show primarily about love and gratitude, but it's about love and gratitude felt, naturally, and expressed on paper and put in an envelope and stamped and mailed to someone. And that'll be your choice who you want to mail it to. But if it isn't mailed, it's not really a love letter. It can be something else beautiful. It can be an essay. It can be a lot of things. But it isn't really a letter until it's mailed.
We have another wonderful guest today.
Yes, we do.
And we'll have another love letter that we're going to hear about. Why don't we just get right into that,
Janet? I'd love to. Our guest today is Dan Field, whom I've known for years since he was a young teen and is now a wonderful grown man who works in Los Angeles. He's a social worker who works with veterans who are homeless and have problems with alcohol and drug abuse. And Dan is a person of really enormous and varying talents, and I think we'll just get right to them. Dan, why don't you talk about how you grew up and what was important to you and some of the things you've done, and go.
Well, I grew up in San Francisco, born and raised in the Richmond District, and I really ate up a lot of the culture and the opportunities that the city had to offer. I took acting classes. I did plays both in community theater and in school. I was involved in various things with my synagogue, you know, being bar mitzvahed and doing some creative
things. And that's definitely
there.
A piece of theater.
That's probably my grandest moment, holding the Torah in front of the entire congregation. And I saw a lot of avant-garde theater, listened to KUSF growing up.
Did you?
Yeah.
Nice.
My brother was really into it, saw some shows at the Mabuhay Gardens, and really just got the flavor for the city and did a lot of
things. So what was that flavor? What sunk in?
Well, taking the bus, Muni, just the diversity, really, of Clement Street. I went to Roosevelt Middle School, and just seeing all of the different restaurants and the type of people, and just being here in the center of a lot of cultural things going on. And I had a lot of different friends in different neighborhoods and just a lot of different good
what
experiences.
What was your favorite thing to do, activities growing up?
Well, as they are now, really going to movies is one of my favorite things to do. And I regret now that so many of the neighborhood movie theaters have gone under. I worked at the Coliseum Theater for a few summers, and I had ways of getting into art houses for free. I'd ask a video store owners for posters, which I would buy for about a dollar, and then I would hawk them at the four-star theater on Clement Street for free movie passes, landmark movie passes. And I went to the Gateway, and went to not the Embarcadero, but a lot of the art theaters. And I would go to movies frequently, both with my friends and on my own.
Okay, so you hear this. People talk about, and especially people who end up in that industry, talk about having been hooked when they were kids. What is it that got you? What is it about movies that...
I think that it's just a visceral experience. It's a transformative, transforming. You are in the movie, or you get so engaged and caught up in the story. It's very exciting, unlike any other art form for me, and I still so enjoy that. You can. UA's slogan was "Escape to the movies," and I would escape to the movies. And thankfully, I had some good guides who pointed me in some good directions, and I saw some excellent movies here in San Francisco growing up.
What were your favorites?
Well, I really liked some of the horror films, and there were double features at the St. Francis that I would drag my friends to, Evil Dead, Mortuary. I wouldn't put those as my favorite movies, but I certainly enjoyed them. And I love Body Heat.
What do you like about those? Because people talk about violence and not being good for kids, and I have a different take on that up to a point. What did you like about horror movies?
I think I like the actual sensation of being scared in a safe environment.
There you go.
To vicariously have a thrill and to just have that excitement. And it was almost like spicy Chinese food. It's more intense and very enjoyable, more so than well, a good drama will be transformative as well. But there was that experience. And then as a young kid, sort of the rebellious nature of going to movies that my mom wouldn't let me go. She didn't know that I was on Market Street seeing double features, and there was kind of that kind of excitement as well.
What wouldn't she wanted you to see?
Well, I saw some pretty hard R-rated movies. Mm-hmm. The Boogeyman. I saw one called Make Them Die Slowly, which I'm not particularly proud of. It was banned in 31 countries.
Not here, though. But you turned out okay.
I turned out okay despite that.
Well, I think you know, that has the same appeal as the Grimm fairy tales and the Marcus Welby. I think we need to see that we can face hideous danger and come out okay. I think it helps us develop some kind of survival assurance. I mean, knowing that we can, that we don't have to be felled by everything that's scary. It's nice to see, as a child, I think, it's wonderful to see the little kid being threatened by the witch and just about put in the oven and then finding out how to escape.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the helpless gets to vanquish the monster.
And that was especially true with good horror films.
I agree,
like Halloween, for example.
I'm so glad to hear you talk about this.
Because the protagonist was a smart, savvy Jamie Lee Curtis. Mm-hmm. And she knew how to fight the boogeyman. And she did it successfully. And
a girl did it. Weakening thing right there.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were a lot of really horrible movies, the Friday the 13th movies, which they tapered off as I became like 15, 16. I tired of them because the formula was pretty much the same, and it was pretty mean-spirited, actually. It was, you know, 11 or 13 camp counselors basically getting chopped up.
But
and
sometimes you have to look the devil in the eye, you know, I think, to know. So what did you morph into from there?
Well, from movies, it was really doing theater and journalism. And, you know, the person that I'm writing my love letter to today is a journalist, a movie critic.
Well, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Because, the whole area of critic, talk about what that is to you.
Well, it's multifaceted. One part of it is reliving a really great experience and analyzing what worked and what didn't work about my favorite artistic medium, movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is just the spirited debate that goes on. If you're fortunate enough to have a movie fan or having gone to a movie, you can have a good give and take about what that experience was like for you. And it really taps into what your values are, what your preferences are. Sometimes I'll see a movie and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I go out and the person I saw it with really hated it. There was a movie called Damage that came out in 92. I was so riveted by it. And I was so just involved with it. And then my friend just couldn't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been other divisive movies like that. It's just interesting to have that debate.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've had that experience also. And there's something really, if you see nothing in a movie, just nothing of any taste, writing, social importance, the music is bad. I mean, there's so many things that can go,
mm-hmm.
and you really detest something. It takes a certain kind of very allowing, nice person to be able to not be irritated with the person who thinks it's great and not think that person's just a superficial jerk.
Yeah, there's some movies that you just really can't stand. There are a lot of feel-good, wannabe Spielberg movies in the 80s that really I hated, you know?
Really?
And I don't know why I hated them so much. I think it says something about me and my abhorrence of certain pop culture stuff that was going on in the 80s. But I also would make some judgment about what I considered mainstream people who enjoyed, you know, movies like The Believers and some other and the Goonies, which I couldn't stand.
Now, do you watch romantic comedies?
I will occasionally see a romantic comedy. They're not my favorite genre, but they're pleasant.
Did you ever see June Bride with Bette Davis and Robert Montgomery?
No.
Oh, put that on your list.
I will.
Please make a list.
I have a list of
that
about 100.
That is so good. Okay, so let's get to the person you're writing to. Talk about what this person is to you and when you first became aware and developed a feeling here.
Well, I caught sneak previews when I was a kid, and I go into this a little bit in my letter. My person of choice, my critic of choice, my number one main man movie critic and good person celebrity that I adore is Roger Ebert. And I have been following his work really since I was about 10. And quite
you saw him on television? Or?
I first caught him on television on the PBS show Sneak Previews. And then eventually, I guess there was a falling out between the PBS station. So he joined Network TV Channel 7, Siskel and Ebert at the movies, Siskel and Ebert and the movies.
And you met him?
I did meet him, yeah. In 1985, he came to the Roxy Theater with Gene Siskel as part of a program, If We Owned the Movie House. And they had a film series of about 8 films that were somewhat obscure. And the films that I saw that day were Nosferatu, The Vampire, and The Buddy Holly Story. And there was a question and answer session afterwards. And it was so exciting to see these people in person. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel were really the first celebrities that I had seen up close. I'd seen them on TV plenty, hundreds of times by that point.
But you already were crazy about them by the time you met them.
I was already crazy about them. I had, in fact, written a letter to them before. To Roger before, to the Chicago Sun-Times. I didn't get a response, so I imagine that he didn't get the letter or something.
And you used to call in, I think you had mentioned.
Well, as sort of my infatuation with movie criticisms and movies in particular, I began to call KGO, News Talk AM 81, and I would become the resident reviewer. This was around the time that Indiana Jones Temple of Doom came out, and there's a lot of stuff about PG-13. And Lee Rogers, the host, liked my reviews so much, which were clearly inspired by Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, that he would have me call in on a weekly basis, and I would do my thing. Yeah, it was very exciting for me.
How did you decide to write to him?
Well,
why now?
Well, he got sick last year. And he's had a struggle with throat cancer and salivary gland cancer really for a couple years now, but he's bounced back pretty nicely.
Oh, good.
And but last year he pulled away from the show. I don't, if you watched Ebert and Roper, you'll know that it's now Roper and guest critics. So Ebert's off and Roper is sort of for now holding the reins. And I really realized that I very much miss Roger Ebert, the show, and more so the print reviews that come out on the internet now weekly on his website. And the feelings that I have for him are very warm and loving and genuine. And I mentioned that to my mom, and she said, well, you should write a letter to him.
Good for her.
And it was right around that time that I was talking to you, and I found out about the show, and this was the perfect impetus for me to actually write the letter to Roger Ebert.
So I want to say something about that in terms of love letters for all of you out there, fan letters as love letters. I don't mean the demented kind where you offer yourself to Elvis Presley, although that's your business. I mean, I wouldn't judge that, but I mean a different kind of love letter where you really talk about what the other person has meant, and there is nobody who won't be touched by a personal letter. I wrote one in my life, actually. I read an article by Francine Duplessis Gray, and it was just stunning. And I wrote to her. I just sent it to The New Yorker, and about a month later, I got the most amazingly wonderful personal letter from her in that spidery little handwriting that nobody learns anymore. And it was just, she was just so thrilled. So write them, write fan letters, and I'm going to ask you to read yours in total, and people can get an idea of how those things can go. Fan letters are love letters, and I apologize for all of you who want to offer yourself to Elvis Presley. That's not my business.
Well, I want to express my love to Roger Ebert, but without any of that overly fandom weirdness, and I hope that I capture that in this letter. So I'll just go ahead and read it.
Please do it.
Dear Roger Ebert, I've been lucky enough to have followed your work since seeing my first Sneak Previews episode in January 1979. The day that show aired was the same day I saw what was my new all-time favorite movie, replacing Silver Streak, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So that day had a lot of meaning for me. It was the day that I saw my favorite movie and what was to become my favorite TV show. Now, since then, Invasion has been surpassed perhaps 150 times over by other great films as my personal best of. But my affection, admiration, and love for your show and work has only expanded with time. My childhood connection with you through Sneak Previews was very strong. I love the anticipation early in the day for the show, the actual experience of watching it. Thursday night, my parents will vouch for this, was like a ritualized holiday. Dinner would be completed by 8, popcorn made, and I'd be in front of the TV without fail. And when a few years later you began releasing the annual Movie Home Companion with your print reviews, they became the staple at Hanukkah time. These books are probably the most oft-read ones in my bookshelf, and I've kept each beloved, tattered copy on my bookshelf at home. Your books, I Hated This Movie, and Questions to the Movie Answer Man, are down with me in Los Angeles, either in my washroom or by my bedside table. Now, what I've gained from following your work is, on the surface, just a first-class education in film history, criticism, and great writing. Your passion for so many of the major filmmakers was my impetus for checking out their films, on video at home, at the reserve room at the library basement, and at the repertory houses, the Red Vic and Roxy in San Francisco. Each wonderful masterwork that I've loved through the 80s and 90s has a Roger Ebert association, either one of your essays or your show. The 28 Up series, Santa Sangre, Blood Simple, Gates of Heaven, to name a few. Even more than this influence, Roger, I see now that what I value about you most is the warmth and positive emotional response that your show and seeing your Chicago Sun-Times reviews brings me personally. Since the late 1970s, you've given me something to look forward to each week. And that something is not just about movies. It's more. There's an enthusiasm for film and for life that you bring, a sense of decency, open-mindedness and values of respect for human dignity and adversity, and a generousness of spirit and love that's unmistakable. This has impacted me emotionally and has instructed me. Now, in the traditional sense, you know, I hardly know you. I've only met you once. But reflecting on my growing up with your influence, I feel a tremendous amount of gratitude for you and the impact of your show and writings. I only realized how deep this impact was when you got sick last year and had to take time to recuperate. I felt a sadness which went way beyond what one feels for a celebrity. It was a sadness that one feels for a trusted, beloved friend. Then I realized that you really have been a friend to me, and a very giving one at that. I know that you're still on the mend, Roger, and I want you to know that along with countless others, I'm thinking good thoughts about you and in support of your speedy recovery. You're a jewel, Roger, and I can honestly say that I love you. Sincerely, your big fan and staunch supporter, Dan Field.
Oh, that is just so wonderful. Oh, my goodness. That just covers absolutely everything. The only thing I want to ask you about is you didn't mention that you were 10 when you started listening.
Yes.
I think you should.
Okay.
I think you should be real specific. I think you've got so much specific in there. It's gorgeous. But wouldn't he be touched to know that he reached somebody that young?
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody that young was smart enough and sensitive enough to pick up what he was doing?
I think you hinted at it when you talked about having dinner and your mother making popcorn and all of that. Mm-hmm.
And you said the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm just
so familiar with 1979 being 10 myself.
Right. And by the way, that's a good point. Sometimes we don't say things that are so second nature to us that we don't bother, but the other guy doesn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just wonderful. And you said, I see that you've got on your papers there some of it handwritten and some of it typed, and you said you were going to mail it this afternoon.
Yes. Well, I wanted to go over it and just for those sort of editorial details, maybe tweak it just a bit.
I wouldn't do anything different except say that you were 10.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
In 1979, so he can see how long he's been part of your life. And you know that business about celebrities, they are part of our lives. They are in our living rooms and in our bedrooms,
mm-hmm.
year in and year out. We're not in theirs.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a one-sided, lopsided relationship, but they wake us up in the morning, they tuck us in at night. I mean, look what Johnny Carson was to the world.
Yeah.
That was your lullaby.
Captain
mm-hmm.
Kangaroo.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, those people are part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So writing to them makes sense.
It does. I mean, I have so much gratitude for Roger Ebert. I can't sing it loudly enough.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
That's singing it pretty loudly right there. I think that's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And what paper will you use?
Well, I'm going to find a nice card. I'm going to write small, I think.
Now, will he be able to read that?
Well, that's a good point. So maybe I'll go to the Gables this afternoon
and get some nice
stationery.
8x11 stationery.
Yeah, 8x11.
And as he gets older, by the way, this is something. because I always advise people to do it in a print. Don't, even when people do use the computer, which I don't think is as good, although sometimes people have to, you want to do it in a large enough print because they may be 40 and 50 now, and small handwriting will be okay. But when they're 90 and want to read it, it won't be fair to them. They won't get to relive it and enjoy it. So I think you should, and your own handwriting, you said.
Absolutely.
But you said a beautiful reason for it.
Well, because he's under the weather, and I want him to get a card that is something that he can hold on to and make him feel better.
But, so why your handwriting?
Well, it's more personal. It's just an expression of me.
That's right. And I think that's really important. Nobody else has your handwriting. Every computer has Chicago and Lucida Bright. So it's not the same. And also, you've touched this. You know, you have touched this paper. It's felt the touch of your hand. You're going to lick that envelope shut.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the handwriting on the envelope. And something that's a gift in the mail.
Yeah.
And that's really what we talk about, love letters, being a custom-designed gift by you for one person in this world. Can't be duplicated, won't have to be returned, and every reading will be as really joyous as the first.
Mm-hmm.
On different levels, perhaps, but...
Well, I hope that it does bring some joy to him, because as I've mentioned in the letter numerous times, and I feel strongly, he's brought a lot of joy for me, both in introducing me to great movies and to... the dialogue that he's had with Gene Siskel and now with Richard Roper, you know, for a long time. I have a great association between great film, great writing, and Roger Ebert.
That's wonderful. And I want to say something about the envelope, because we're talking... I've, on occasion, gotten letters with no return address. Now, the that's not so smart, because if it gets lost, you know, that's not good. It's beautiful faith in the post office. But sometimes things do go awry. And also there's something really lovely, I think, about looking at an envelope. I look at envelopes very carefully before I open them. Do you?
Yeah.
I mean, it starts there. And if I recognize the handwriting, that's a joy enough. But if I don't, if it's from someone I don't know, I look at the return address. I look at what city it's from. I look at the postmark and see when it was mailed. And I think people do that. And so the return address... on top of which, he may want to write back to you.
That would be amazing.
And we don't do it for those reasons. It's just a gift you're sending.
Mm-hmm.
We don't
That's
do it for
right.
what we're going to get back. But if he wanted to, the additional gift is he's going to know where to find you.
That
and
would
have
be,
a relationship with somebody if he likes.
That would be thrilling. That would be thrilling.
Okay, so you remember to do that.
I will.
Your return address.
I will.
Okay.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's really so infrequent that you get a piece of personal correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
You get
right.
so many, you know, form letters and credit card statements and stuff.
Yes.
That it really is special
get
to get something that you can
mortgage
hold.
Opportunities.
You toss all that other stuff aside, and you just have that personal note.
Do you toss letters away if you don't recognize where it comes from or the address or the handwriting? Handwriting.
Oh, generally, if they're typewritten and you know if they're solicitations, I can tell right away.
Can't you though?
Yeah. And I get so many of them. You know, I live in a studio apartment, and you know, I for every one letter of personal correspondence, and they usually come in December, I get perhaps 39.
Yes,
solicitations.
Of course. It's diminishing.
Yeah.
You know something? My husband and I have been married for 19 years now, and he still gets. He's on some singles list. And so he still gets every once in a while a, you know, find your perfect mate envelope, which is just ludicrous. And also occupant and resident. And sometimes he keeps those, poor thing, because he says, well, I haven't looked at it yet. I don't know. And I say, they don't care about you. It's not to you. He feels, you know, you want something.
I actually created an alias when I was little. Actually, the alias of my telephone movie critic personality, Jake Wynn, was also, I would send that name out to a lot of companies,
yeah.
I got all kinds of weird solicitations.
And you know
which
people have sent your...
Yeah, they were interested in Jake Wynn. He was a smoker. He was overweight.
Oh,
he had health
problems.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you mean things?
Yeah, so I got a lot of letters for Jake. I still do to this day, my parents' address.
We subscribe to the Wall Street Journal in the name of our dog. And we get all kinds of mail with our zip code in the Wall Street
Journal.
Dear
Mr. Dog.
Oh, he's been invited to join the Businessman's Roundtable. And we get phone calls, actually.
That is so funny.
Asking for Butch.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I have a tip. My father figured this out. When you can't get yourself off a mailing list for one of these people and you write to them and write to them and write to them and please remove, and the person's deceased and the person's living in, you know, Bangladesh and no longer here, and it does no good. What you do is in the change of address slot, you write their address. And forever, that will be the change of address they'll respect. And somebody will key that in, and they will be sending themselves that letter eternally.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, they can keep it.
So, Mark Bien.
Okay. Dad, quick question for you. You loved the movie Invasion.
No, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I was never privileged to watch that. But what was Roger Ebert's take on that movie? Did he like it?
Well, he gave it 3 stars. He thought it was a pretty serviceable remake of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 1960 film. I'm talking about the Donald Sutherland, Leonard Nimoy remake.
The first one.
No, the remake, which was so wonderfully shot in San Francisco. It was just such an, you know, when you're a kid and you see a movie that transports you and is like an adventure, that movie really had that for me. But his take of it was that it was pretty good, you know, about as good as the original.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, oddly enough, the night that I met Roger Ebert, he invited all of us to a party. I met him at the Roxy Theater, and there was a Chinese restaurant across the street, and it was a bar restaurant, and kind of snuck in, and who was there but the director of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Philip Kaufman. So there I was with Roger Ebert and Philip Kaufman in the same room. And,
Were you in heaven?
I was in heaven. I was so excited.
But the remake, I have a question. You've seen the original, obviously.
Yeah.
So the original was a very clear beware of the spread of communism. I mean, it was just ludicrous. It was just so transparent and kind of goofy.
Yeah.
But couldn't have been in the
remake.
The remake
was more of a kind of straightforward, scary science fiction narrative.
That's what it sounds
where
like,
they're
yeah.
body snatchers and they're walking down Market Street mm-hmm. and they are hungry for
right.
sleepy souls.
Because I think the first body snatchers were, you know, Lenin and Stalin.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it wasn't an overt political statement, but it was a lot of fun.
I didn't see the remake, so I just wondered about that.
Go rent it.
Okay.
Netflix it. It's a good one.
I Netflix a lot.
Yeah.
Well, this is a little different format than we usually go to. We've gotten into movie reviews, but a terrific love letter.
Oh, wonderful.
I hope that, I know you're not writing it for that reason, but I hope that Roger Ebert will respond. My daughters have written, as children, wrote several fan letters, one to Weird Al, one to Jim Davis, who draws Garfield,
uh-huh.
and the last one was to Kurt Vonnegut, not too long ago, and each one of them responded personal, in one case a postcard, and the other with a letter.
And Dahlia wrote to Pat Conroy when she was about 12.
I remember that.
And she got a beautiful letter back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, a few weeks later, and I saw it in the mail, and it said Pat Conroy, because I read those return addresses. And I figured it was some kid she went to camp with. I mean, I just didn't make the connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember she loved that The Prince of Tides, and she mm-hmm. just wrote him to tell him how much that she adored that book.
Yeah.
Well, again, thank you so much, Ben, for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. And please visit our website at www.loveletterslive.com. We would love to hear your responses to programs like this. We'd love to hear your examples of love letters that you have sent or received, or questions for Janet, any of the above.
And remember that you are listening to KUSF. 90.3 FM. And I just want to say, if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, just remember that writing a love letter is a special occasion.
Right. And we encourage you to put those thoughts into words and send them while you still have the chance.
And that means while the other person is here, if possible, and certainly while you're here.
Right. So until next week, with love from Teresa
and Janet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.